Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. What does a win-at-all-costs attitude actually cost, especially when wielded by one of the most powerful athletics companies in the world?
My name is Kara Goucher. I'm a two-time Olympian. I'm a wife and a mother. My son jokes that I have a million jobs, but I still run a lot. I promote running.
Goucher is a celebrated American long-distance runner, a three-time NCAA champion in cross-country and the 3,000 and 5,000 meters, a world championship silver medalist, and a top three finisher in the New York and Boston marathons. In American running, Goucher was among the elite. And the elite often run for one of the most influential athletics companies in the world. They run for Nike.
So I signed with Nike in 2001, and Nike invited me to come and visit their campus after the NCAA championships. And I was blown away. I mean, they wined and dined us and showed us all around. And it really felt like I would be crazy not to take this offer. It wasn't a huge contract, but it was enough that I could focus on running full time. And yeah, it just seemed like this is what you dream about, being a Nike athlete. I'd worn Nikes my whole life. You know, it was like, this is the dream.
Well, in the early 2000s, Nike embarked on a new mission, the Nike Oregon Project. Nike Vice President Thomas Clark wanted to recapture the glory days of American long-distance running back in the 1980s when Americans frequently won the biggest races in the world. So the company brought on board one of the biggest names in running, superstar Alberto Salazar, who'd won three consecutive New York City marathons in the early 1980s. In 2004, Kara Goucher joined the team.
We went out to visit the Oregon Project, and it was very similar to when I visited the Nike campus 3 years earlier. It just seemed like we were insane to not take this opportunity on. You know, we really just said, if we pass this up, we're crazy.
And for a while, the project yielded results.
But I would say it wasn't until really after I won a medal at the World Championships in 07 that it really started to shift. The culture of the team really started to shift. It really started to become all about results and, you know, no longer about development, really, like you have to perform, like put up or shut up, basically. And so it just, the culture of the team really started to shift from what we had initially signed on to.
In 2009, Kara Goucher finished third in the Boston Marathon, a fantastic finish by most standards. But for Salazar and Nike, it wasn't good enough.
You know, it was the first time that I was let known that Nike was counting on me to win, and there were things in place for me when I won. And now all these people had worked so hard and I had let that down. Oh, I definitely felt a responsibility to the company. I mean, when I finished, I just was overcome with emotion because I knew how many people I had let down.
Salazar pushed them hard, and according to Goucher, in ways that were against the anti-doping rules that governed professional running. She says she saw teammates faking dehydration to get IVs at big competitions.
My coach would joke about how to fake it to get these IVs. My coach asked me to take a prescription drug that I didn't have a prescription for to help me shed weight faster after I had my son. And there was just things like that that I started to see that weren't like, I didn't walk in and my teammates were shooting themselves up with EPO or, you know, I didn't see that, but I saw stuff that was absolutely against the rules and it was being treated like it was no big deal.
Goucher left the Nike Oregon Project in 2011. She took an even bigger step right after that. She decided to come forward and meet with the head of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency.
Remember, we're talking about Alberto Salazar, who is funded by the biggest brand in the world and is backed by the biggest brand in the world. And so it's not like I'm ratting out a teammate that makes $30,000 a year. I'm like, saying stuff that happened on the Nike campus that was paid for by Nike, that Nike was aware of, right? So it just felt really scary to put myself in that position.
Goucher's report spurred an investigation into Alberto Salazar and the Nike Oregon Project. Soon, there were more allegations of sexual misconduct, physical and emotional abuse, those allegations made against Salazar. Well, on October 1st, 2019, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency banned Salazar. And just over a week later, Nike shut down the Oregon project. Salazar denies the charges and allegations against him. But this summer, the U.S. Center for Safe Sport banned Salazar for life. And a month later, in August of 2021, Nike renamed the Alberto Salazar Building at its Beaverton, Oregon headquarters. But this story isn't over yet. Just last week, professional runner Mary Kane sued Salazar and Nike for $20 million, alleging he physically and emotionally abused her. Kane joined the team when she was just 16 years old. Now, we reached out to Nike and requested a representative from the company joined us. They declined, but they sent this statement, quote, "We don't comment on ongoing litigation. Nike is committed to positively affecting the future of sport for women and girls, and we are doing more in this space than ever before," end quote. This whole story raises some very important questions, though, in the world of athletics. How did alleged abuse inside one of the world's top training teams, funded by one of the world's biggest running companies, perhaps the biggest, go on for so long? And in a sport like professional running, where the opportunities are slim and the pay uncertain, where does all of this leave the athletes themselves? Who is really paying the price for a corporate-sponsored win-at-all-costs attitude? Well, Matt Hart joins us now. He's author of Win at All Costs, Inside Nike Running and Its Culture of Deception. Matt, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So first of all, tell us a little bit more of what Alberto Salazar was alleged to have done while leading the Nike Oregon project.
Yeah, so as Kara detailed, you know, the team initially in the first few years, the Oregon project team, didn't have much success. Then they, you know, sought out the Gauchers and some better athletes around 2004. And it seems as though Alberto, you know, during his career as a Nike athlete, he had been one of the top athletes, as you mentioned. But he had overcooked himself. He had trained himself into a physiological hole and, you know, to a point where he had considered suicide and was depressed. And what he did with the help from some clever doctors is he brought himself back out of this hole with prednisone and prescription drugs and some use of testosterone. And so as the intensity of the Nike Oregon project team around 2009 was sort of ramping up, it seems as though he basically waded into these gray areas, these gray waters, where he started, you know, sitting in with the athletes and their doctor's appointments, getting them on prescription drugs that they didn't need. You know, they wouldn't fail a test. They were clinically within the normal range, but the doctor, Dr. Jeffrey Brown, who was also banned from sport, would prescribe them the drugs anyway because they bestowed a performance enhancement. So that was sort of some gray area tactics he was doing. But really, in 2009, one of the two anti-doping violations he was banned for was trafficking in testosterone. This was a substance he had used in his own life and career. And he had set up an experiment on his sons, actually, who had both become Nike employees, where they were working out in the Lance Armstrong Fitness Center on the Nike campus. They took a urine test. They rubbed testosterone on their backs, on their skin, on their bare skin. And then they took another urine test to figure out really where the line was, where how much cream would cause a failed anti-doping test. So that was 2009. And the second offense was the L-carnitine, an amino acid, a supplement that had recently emerged from some research in the UK as possibly being beneficial to endurance athletes and how they use fat fuel for source of fat for running. And so he had used an illegal procedure to get this L-carnitine into the athletes. There's rules around how much injected and infused substances you can use as an athlete in a certain period of time. It's 50 milliliters in a 6-hour period. And you know, he was found to be giving as much as 1,000 milliliters in a 6-hour period.
Well, Matt, let me just jump in here because, I mean, this all leads towards the obvious question of this was a win-at-all-costs operation. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, the program really morphed into that, as Kara said, around 2007. And interestingly, Alberto had had a heart incident in 2007. But yeah, at some point, you know, they really were focused on, you know, getting athletes on the podiums of Olympic championships.
Okay. And Do we know, because you heard Kara Goucher say that a lot of this, well, and actually you just said, a lot of this was happening on the Nike campus in Beaverton, Oregon. I mean, to me, that makes it seem like the company knew of these.
Yeah.
I mean, did they?
Mark Parker, the CEO at the time, knew of the testosterone tests. He's, you know, there was evidence in email that came out through the United States Anti-Doping Agency investigation that he knew. He was in communication with both the doctor, Jeffrey Brown, and Salazar about the tests. So Nike knew quite a bit. I mean, it, like you said, it was happening on their campus, in their facilities. And so it does seem like they knew most of what he was up to.
Okay. So, I mean, here's one of the reasons why this matters is that describe to us what the name Nike means in the world of running.
Oh, wow. I mean, it's the goddess of victory, but initially, but the name has come to me. I mean, so Nike, you know, started in the 60s in Oregon and through the 70s was really a scrappy American underdog brand. Adidas was the global dominant brand at the time in sportswear and shoes. And so Nike really saw themselves as the underdog fighting the Germans, really. And so through the 80s, through some wildly effective alchemy of clever marketing, innovative products, and skullduggery, they became the you know, the most dominant sports brand and surpassed Adidas in 1983 in total sales. Now, there was a blip there while they misread the aerobics trend and lost the top spot to Reebok. But then since the late 80s, they've been the most dominant brand in sport. You know, if you just look at their market capitalization, you know, they're four times Adidas at this point. You know, they're head and shoulders above all the other brands. They sponsor many of the events. Many of the events wouldn't happen without Nike's sponsorship and largesse and investment. And they've sponsored more athletes and paid more professional athletes than any other brand in the world.
And this is particularly important in the world of running, right?
Mm-hmm. This running is their foundational sport. You know, Phil Knight was a runner at the University of Oregon, where he was coached by Bill Bowerman. And those are the two men that started the brand.
Yeah, as a person who grew up in Oregon myself, everyone knew who Phil Knight was. I mean, the University of Oregon campus is being transformed by Phil Knight's money. And everyone knew who Alberto Salazar was as well. So the two in combination then, the question we'll talk about when we come back, Matt, is where does all this leave the athletes who were running for Nike? So we'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are talking about the latest chapter in a scandal in long-distance running, and that is how Nike and Alberto Salazar treated runners who ran for them in what was once known as the Nike Oregon Project. And the bigger question of what does a win-at-all-costs attitude do to the athletes who are asked to do the winning? And we're joined today by Matt Hart. He's author of Win at All Costs, Inside Nike Running and Its Culture of Deception. And again, as a reminder, we did reach out to Nike to see if they could join us today, and they declined due to ongoing litigation. And we will talk about that litigation a little bit more in a minute. But Matt, so first of all, can you just describe to us a little bit more about what was in it for the runners who joined the Nike Oregon Project? Because as Kara Goucher hinted to in the first part of our show today, the runners weren't actually making all that much money. So talk to me about what the draw would be and what they would hope to get out of being associated or working for the Nike Oregon Project.
Yeah, I mean, most of the time, I think these athletes, these young people grow up dreaming of being a sponsored athlete, dreaming of possibly running as a profession. You know, it's a very narrow band there. There aren't that many professional athletes, and there are even fewer still who, you know, make a legitimate living. Most of the professional athletes we know of, don't have health insurance, for instance. And so joining Nike as the global sports marketing brand that they are, you know, is just a feather in your cap. It legitimizes you. They often can offer, even though it's sometimes not very much money, all things considered, a bigger contract because they've, you know, like we talked about earlier, they make more, they sell more shoes and clothes than any other brand. And so there's a prestige aspect to it, being sponsored by Nike. But then I think it's just the fruition of a dream, really. You know, most of these athletes have been running hard and training diligently their whole lives. And so they see Nike, as the best sponsor, the biggest sponsor in the world, and sort of the chance to continue to chase their dreams to the Olympics.
Mm. And Kara Goucher had said that, you know, some of her fellow athletes, and correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, but even in the midst of working for the Nike Oregon Project, we're making, what, just $30,000 a year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes it's even less than that. But from my interviews with athletes who are often remiss to talk about their contracts, because Nike puts NDAs, non-disclosures, into the contracts where they're not technically allowed to tell a journalist, for instance, how much they make. But, you know, if the athlete was a national championship on the NCAA level in Kara's era, it was around $30,000, I think. That's most commonly what I heard.
That's basically nothing, honestly. But what they get out of it is the opportunity to be supported, essentially, mm-hmm. by the world's biggest athletics company.
Right. It's more of an opportunity than it is a career, I think, because there are really small percentage of those athletes who go on to make hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions of dollars, if you reach the peaks of Olympic fame.
Okay. So let's circle back to something that you were talking about earlier. A lot of this, essentially illegal in terms of the rules of professional running worldwide, were happening allegedly on the Nike campus. So what are the forces that I don't know if this is the right way of putting it, that protected protected Salazar? And do we know if the international governing bodies had any clue that this was going on?
Well, I think what ended up happening, so Salazar, I should start with Phil Knight, I guess. Phil Knight, you know, he's sort of emeritus now, he's stepped aside, but through these years, he really was still involved with the program. Alberto, you know, had won his last marathon in 83, and Nike became the dominant brand, really surpassing Adidas in 84. So they sort of hand in hand, I think Phil Knight saw Alberto as helping him grow the brand. You know, and then through those same years, Lance Armstrong, for instance, was, you know, helping Nike as a Nike athlete really grow and advance the brand. Armstrong was in the 2000s, but he became close to them. So Phil Knight became really close to Lance Armstrong. He became close to these athletes. He treated them like sons. And so I think there's an aspect there to protecting your own, circling the wagons, where, you know, Nike really first and foremost believes their employees and their impressive athletes. Now, as far as the organizations are concerned, there's a real cross-pollinization going. The head of World Athletics is a former Nike athlete. The head of USA Track and Field, USATF, a former Nike coach, Vin Lanana. And so Nike really has its tendrils in all the governing bodies. Now, they don't have any tendrils in USADA, the United States Anti-Doping Agency, or WADA that I'm aware of, the anti-doping agencies that govern sports. But, you know, they've, much like the EPA and the oil and gas companies, they trade employees and presidents, which is, of course, advantageous to them when rule breaking comes up.
Wow. Well, and then again, I keep thinking of, and at the same time, we have professional athletes who are literally giving their souls and bodies to this project, making barely $30,000 a year. Look, we've got listener comments coming in, and if you're listening and you're a runner or an athlete or a coach even, hop on Facebook and Twitter. We're at On Point Radio, and let us know what you think about this question of what happens when a corporation is involved at in a win-at-all-costs attitude. Who really pays the cost for that? Joe Roberts is telling us on Facebook, very sad, but there are coaches out there that do not care about their athlete's future. Just the here and now and winning at all costs. Well, Matt, stand by here for just a second because I want to hear a little bit from Mary Kane, the runner who came out publicly with allegations against Nike and Alberto Salazar and has that ongoing $20 million litigation. She says things might have been different for her if she'd worked with more women while running for Nike. Here she is in a 2019 video op-ed from the New York Times where Mary Kane shared her story for the first time.
We need more women in power. Part of me wonders if I had worked with more female psychologists, nutritionists, and even coaches, where I'd be today. I got caught in a system designed by and for men, which destroys the bodies of young girls.
It's Mary Kane in a New York Times op-ed from 2019. Well, just this week, Kara Goucher, also the former champion runner, told us that the lack of women at all levels of Nike's leadership was pretty evident when she stepped on campus.
When I went to visit the first time before I had a contract, I remember my husband asked about, well, what happens if she gets pregnant? And the whole room, it was all men. And it was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you asked that, you know? And so I knew early on it was definitely like a male-dominated culture, male-dominated atmosphere, male-dominated business.
And once again, a reminder that we did reach out to Nike to join us for this hour, and they declined, citing that ongoing litigation. Well, joining us now is Lindsay Krause. She's with us from New York. She's senior staff editor at the New York Times and has reported extensively on women and athletics. Lindsay, welcome to you.
Hi.
So you have reported on issues of gender within Nike. I mean, can you just first of all tell us what power or influence does Nike have with the world of women's running in particular?
Sure. Well, I think what's really important to remember about Nike is that for many years, and you could still make the case that for now, women's sports, women's running in particular, part of why it's so influential and successful in the U.S. is because of Nike and the investment that it's put into this sport. And that's part of what's enabled its power in this arena. And I mean, growing up, I remember I was a runner and an athlete as well. And I just thought of Nike as synonymous with the sport and the industry. And that's all to say that they've done a great job with their marketing. But part of that outcome of that marketing is inspiration. It's real and real financial investment. And that has led to real power and given it a sort of omnipotence in sports, but also particularly women's sports, which are historically undervalued and where there is more of an opportunity to have influence.
Right. And in fact, I mean, that's what Nike pointed to when they sent us their statement after we requested their appearance today, because just to say again, they said, quote, Nike is committed to positively affecting the future of sport for women and girls, and we are doing more in this space than ever before, end quote. But Lindsay, you know, you heard Mary Kane there in that 2019 op-ed for the New York Times, a video op-ed, talking about not having the chance to work with, while she was running, more female psychologists, nutritionists, and even coaches. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, of course. I mean, Nike was founded by men in the 70s. You know, Phil Knight, Bill Bowerman, Steve Prefontaine was the legendary face of it. And that continued on. I mean, the CEO, when I was doing all of this reporting in 2019, it was another man, Mark Parker. And I think it's really important to note that a lot of the policies that I wound up reporting on that kind of amounted to gender discrimination, a lot of it wasn't this sort of dogma that was handed down from on top saying that we will oppress women. I think what wound up happening in a lot of cases was almost like a willful ignorance. And that's what happens when you have a lot of men in power, men making decisions and men hiring the men down the line that are then dealing with women who like Mary or like Kara or like Alice and Felix, for example. These men are making decisions from their point of view. And I don't think that always amounts to some malicious, like, we want to punish you, but that's the outcome. Yeah. And so that's why you need more men.
Well, no, this is a decision. Yeah. So this is a really important point, and I'm wondering if you could help us understand it in more detail. So what were some of those policies that you reported on that essentially, as you said, amounted to gender discrimination, even if that wasn't the intent?
Sure. Well, for example, with pregnancy, a lot of athletic apparel companies like Nike, they claim to elevate female athletes, but in the case of, but a lot of them in their actual contracts were not written with a woman's, you know, life in mind, not to mention her athletic career. And so a lot of them have these clauses that say that you have to compete for a certain number, or you have to compete in races in certain time intervals that are just fundamentally incompatible with having a baby. You know, not only the period of time where you are physically pregnant and unable to run fast, but also the period that you need for recovery and to come back and also to get back to the top of your game. And so what was happening in a lot of these contracts is that pregnancy was being treated as an injury. And obviously, that wasn't the intent, but you just have people making these decisions without even thinking, you know, as Kara said in her interview with you, not even thinking about what might happen if someone would have a baby, because they weren't thinking that was compatible with pro sports, at least in the athletic area. Of course, in the marketing area, that was totally different.
Yeah. Well, Matt and Lindsay, we actually talked a little bit more with Kara Goucher about pregnancy and running for Nike. And she told us that when she decided to have a baby, she spoke openly about it with her coach. And together, they decided the best time for her to become a mom. And that was after the World Championships in 2009.
And at the time, you know, my husband had asked years earlier, what happens when Kara gets pregnant? And they said, well, we don't have a pregnancy policy. So at the time, we just wanted to know what was going to happen, you know? And so my coach, Alberto Salazar, went to the head of sports marketing, John Capriati, and said, you know, what's going to happen to Kara's contract? And he said, don't even go there. She's so popular right now. As long as she stays relevant, it'll be no big deal. So I did like 18 appearances during my pregnancy. I was flying all around the United States. I was shooting, doing photo shoots, making appearances. And about 6 months into my pregnancy, my financial advisor said, you know, like, oh, you didn't get your quarterly payment. I was like, oh, I'm just sure they're busy. It's fine. And by the time I finally got a hold of them, they said that I was suspended indefinitely due to my medical condition.
Her medical condition being pregnancy. And Kara Goucher also told us that Nike was using her pregnancy, she thinks, as a marketing tool to sell women on the idea that they could have it all.
In fact, Nike orchestrated the announcement of my pregnancy. The announcement of my pregnancy was on the front page of the New York Times sports section on Mother's Day when I was about halfway through my pregnancy, and Nike orchestrated that entire thing. You know, they picked the story, they picked the source, everything. And so you're showing me as this mother and that you support mothers and you support women who can do it all, who are strong. And yet I go home and I'm not getting paid.
Matt Hart, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's disheartening to say the least. I think there's a shocking level of hypocrisy coming from Beaverton and Nike. You know, as has been pointed out, they really hold these women athletes up in their marketing and promotion, and then, you know, kind of do the exact opposite behind closed doors. It seems to me like a direct and natural outgrowth from sort of this boys club, if you will, at the top of Nike corporate. You know, while I was reporting, their next in line to be CEO, Trevor Edwards, was, you know, involved in a scandal that's still playing out in the courtroom, and he's been let go, as has his whole team. And, you know, women described this Nike corporate environment as an impossible pyramid, impossible to climb for women. And so it seems like to me that, you know, what's happening in the boardroom is also sort of an outgrowth and happening on the Nike Oregon project when it was on campus.
Lindsay, would love to hear from you too on this.
Yeah, I think that, again, like in 2018, when some of my colleagues reported a number of female colleagues at Nike talking about, you know, strip clubs and unwanted touching and kissing and all of this work or all of these unfortunate outcomes that kind of amounted to gender discrimination at Nike, there wasn't change that happened quickly enough. And I think it was very clear with a lot of the reporting that I did on the athletic side in 2019 that what was happening, just as Matt said, what was happening among the employees was mirroring what was happening for the athletes, particularly female athletes. And you could certainly make the case that executives at Nike were not quick enough to kind of listen to these canaries in the coal mine and make the necessary changes that could have saved them from, you know, some public embarrassment and continued the goodwill that they were trying to achieve with their marketing.
Mm. Well, but as far as I understand, though, after your reporting about this, though, Lindsay, Nike was responsive, right? It changed. What specifically did they do regarding contracts and pay for pregnant athletes who that were running for Nike?
Yeah, well, I think that was what was really exciting is that when I did a lot of this reporting, it was all, especially with athletes that were currently experiencing these issues, it was all off the my sourcing was off the record because there was real fear and there was also a defeatism among the athletes that I heard so many times that Nike won't care, they will never change. And I told them that very well may be true, especially for athletes for whom this was in the past. I said that if Nike were to sue you, at least we can, you know, get that the media attention and the public public scrutiny that it would deserve. And we were so excited after that happened. And I think what happened first was, you know, there was a major public outcry, much more than we ever expected. And then a congressional inquiry. I think, you know, America loves mothers. We had, you know, on both sides of the aisle, we had conservatives, we had liberals, all kind of uniting around these women. And then finally, Nike did announce a new maternity policy in August. So it took months, but it did. And now if you see women athletes having children now, they are like Alex Morgan, for example, the soccer player, she has cited this work as totally leaving her protected, which is really exciting.
Well, we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and just want to give you a heads up about something we're going to be talking about a little later this week. California housing. So California listeners, perk up your ears because we're going to be talking about the recently signed bills in California that will allow single-family zoned plots of land to be used for multifamily housing projects, so duplexes, etc. So if you are a listener in California, we want to know what you think about, A, these new rules changes. Are they a great idea to help relax California's housing crisis, or are they not a good idea? Does it sort of change what a neighborhood might look like or be like? Is your neighborhood changing from single-family homes with backyards to denser multi-unit apartment buildings? And for the rest of the United States, what do you think about new rules or new ways to look at zoning as a way to make housing more plentiful and more affordable? So tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We're going to be talking about California and housing, not a little subject in the Golden State. That's for later this week. Today, we are talking about who really pays the price when a corporation backs a win-at-all-costs attitude in professional athletics, and specifically in the world of professional running. And I'm joined today by Lindsay Krauss. She's a senior staff editor at the New York Times and has reported extensively on this issue, specifically regarding Nike. And Matt Hart is with us. He's author of Win at All Costs, Inside Nike Running and Its Culture of Deception. So, Lindsay and Matt, I will fully admit that I am not an athlete. The longest time I've run was after a soccer ball on a field. So there's a lot about the world of elite running that I don't understand. So I'm just going to expose my ignorance here. So help me understand something, though, about how it works. Because unlike team sports, right, runners don't have a team to negotiate with. They don't have a union, as far as I know, to help set rates for what it means to be a professional in the field. And so in that sense, they are incredibly beholden to their sponsors or major corporations like Nike that are paying a lot for facilities, for coaches, for technology to help them become better runners. So how do we understand where the line should be in terms of what a corporation and a corporate-sponsored coach can ask a runner to do? Because, I mean, really, it's like by definition, their bodies are the product. Matt, do you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I think it's a really tricky question. You know, these athletes have been working on their bodies through nutrition and obviously the training for so many years that that is their commodity. That's what they're there to offer, you know, some exposure through, you know, winning of races. You know, that things have changed a little bit with social media. You don't have to be an Olympic gold medalist to be a famous athlete anymore. You can be on the sort of influencer spectrum. But, you know, as far as the athletes at Nike, it really was, they were disadvantaged in that, you know, Salazar and the Nike contract could be, you know, dangled over their heads if they weren't performing or they weren't racing as often as they were supposed to, as was dictated in the contract. And so, yeah, where is that line? I think the athlete, you know, it's each one of the athlete's responsibility to figure out where their sort of moral compass is. And I think that's what happened in this story. Kara, at some point, this had, you know, this abrasiveness, this, what they're asking her to do, it bumped up against, you know, her moral compass and well-being so many times. And that happened with Mary too, as well, but that they eventually spoke out. But I think it's, you know, it's incumbent on the athlete. They're responsible for what they put into their bodies, and you know, they're responsible for, at the end of the day, they're holding the bag if they do something wrong, if the coach or athlete has coerced them into something. But
they're holding the bag, not the company.
Right. Generally speaking, yeah, they're going to be banned if they're caught, you know, using a prohibited substance or method, and they'll lose their, you know, their livelihood.
So, Lindsay, I mean, this is kind of the definition of a catch-22 for the athletes, right? Because we learned from Matt's book that, like, the Nike Oregon Project, they really were putting a lot of money behind it, right? I mean, the idea was they get to train on the, you know, the famed Beaverton campus. They would get all the technology they needed. Matt, I mean, you even talked about how, they had a house that they would, like, pressurize or depressurize to the equivalent of an altitude of, what, more than 10,000 feet, so they could essentially train at high altitude by not being in high altitudes. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here which an individual runner on their own wouldn't have access to. And yet, Lindsay, we just heard Matt say that it falls to a runner's individual compass, a moral compass, when she says, well, I'm not comfortable with just being on just this side of the line regarding, you know, putting testosterone in my system. What other supports do they have?
Do you mean from a training perspective?
Well, I mean, is it as clear as it sounds that they're incredibly beholden to what their coach wants them to do and what the corporate sponsor is willing to support?
Sure. And I think that's where some of this gray area, especially with women athletes, gets really interesting, because when you look at a woman who wants to be pregnant, right, or even just becomes pregnant and then has to make some decisions from there and literally has to integrate this into her career, in that case, Nike sees the value of it. And so that was pretty clear to me, is that it's a company where it the marketing department sees the value, but it's not communicating that to the actual department that's paying these athletes from a racing perspective, based on their race performances. So there's that. But then, I mean, if you're Mary Keane, you're 17 years old going out to Nike. I think that that totally changes the power dynamics in an entirely other direction. She's investing in her career and of course wants to be the best in the world by many metrics. She already sort of is. And of course you just want to be with the best. You want to be with the best coach, with the best brand, kind of continuing this rise. And in that case, I think Nike just really was the place, and you can get sucked into that. And then finally it's when things aren't going the way you thought they were, that's when the rose colored glasses come off.
So I'm speaking from a place of ignorance about sports. But like, do athletes, say, who are team athletes, NBA, NFL, soccer, etc., I mean, do they have that additional layer of institutional infrastructure of the team to help protect them? And that's something that the individual athletes, like runners, just don't have, Lindsay.
Absolutely. When you look at, say, the WNBA, for example, which has really been under Commissioner Kathy Engelbert, a woman, has been a real trailblazer here. They have those athletes in that league have not only the protection of the team, but also the league. And in particular, a players union, which is able to advocate on the player's behalf. When you look at distance runners, just for example, they're more considered to be independent contractors, which there are many similarities in my mind to people operating in the gig economy at this point. You have no one advocating for you. You are really beholden to the interests of this company, whose job at the end of the day is to make money off of you, and it will support you to make money that it then in turn can have coming back to it, but it's not necessarily going to help you more than that. And so if you look at the WNBA, for example, it's been tremendously successful in getting more for its athletes. I think it even has egg freezing in the contract at this point. Just, you know, maternity benefits that are really pushing the boundaries of what, or really leading the way. And you could see something like distance running, for example, where there is a lot less organization, there isn't a union, kind of being on the opposite of that spectrum.
So let's talk for a few minutes about what could be done then to sort of further support, protect, or make professional athletes, individual athletes, less like gig economy workers, Lindsay, like you said. I mean, honestly, when you said that, things started clicking into place for me here a little bit. So we talked to Sally Burgesson. She's the founder and CEO of Wazelle, a women's running apparel company based in Seattle. And like Nike, Wazelle has a roster of professional athletes that the company sponsors. But Sally said Nike is so powerful in the sport because of their deep ties with the national governing body for track and field, the USATF, which makes the rules for the sport.
I mean, I would say by and large, the sport of elite running has a conflict of interest problem. And this is something we've talked about quite a bit, but it really does go back to that exclusive relationship that Nike does have with USATF. So there's this massive corporation, right? They're the 800-pound gorilla. And the USATF is, you know, in the scale of things, very small in comparison to that. And because of that relationship, they really control a lot of what the USATF does, what their priorities are, the way they treat athletes, how they feel about athletes unionizing, for example. So that's another example of where the sport is behind other sports, in that there's no union for professional athletes and there's no collective bargaining. So that really creates an environment where all of the athletes are very isolated and they don't have leverage or power, whether it's negotiating a contract or whether it's standing up for their rights or whether it's questioning the governing body, because everybody's so afraid that they're going to lose the little bit that they do have.
And just to clarify again, the governing body is USATF or USA Track and Field. Now, for Wazelle CEO Sally Burgesson, one way to reform the system, she thinks, is to look closely at contracts brands are asking athletes to sign. And she described to us what Wazelle's professional contract looks like.
I think our contracts are most notable for maybe what they don't have in them. We don't have any reductions. You know, reductions are basically like, you know, if you don't raise in 3 months, we're going to cut your pay, or we're going to kick you out, or even reactive, like retroactive reductions. Some contracts like claw back money that they've already paid to the athlete. Things like that, we just don't do any of those things.
And she also says track and field needs to take a hard look at which companies are visible during major world events, say like the Olympics. One brand sponsors athletes at world championships, that would be Nike, and current rules prevent other brands from appearing on American athletes' uniforms.
Nike is the owner of that uniform. And so really it oppresses and depresses the value of the athletes because they can't give any visibility to their sponsors that they have. So Wazelle is a sponsor of athletes, but Wazelle disappears when they go off to the Olympics. Lauren Fleshman made a proposal to the USATF to create space on an athlete's uniform for their own personal sponsor, the sponsor that puts money in their pocket. So that would be a really important step that has, surprise, surprise, been stonewalled.
And by the way, Lauren Fleshman is formerly the coach of Wazelle's elite running team. Okay, so Lindsay and Matt, let me first turn to you here. So several different ideas that Sally Bergeson just gave there. First of all, talk about unions. Is that anywhere on the horizon for elite running?
Not that I'm aware of. Yeah, I mean, this is also a problem in professional cycling, and they're sort of rallying around and at least beginning stages of talking about it. But I just haven't heard the interest or the organization probably from the professional running. Maybe Lindsay can correct me there, but I haven't seen much talk about this. They really are. The athletes are sort of often in their own little satellite. Usually they're not on the Nike campus. They're living wherever they train and are from. And just, you know, with minimal communication with their sponsor. So, you know, this Nike situation and a few others are similar. There are great and varied training groups that are sponsored by other brands throughout the country. But, yeah, so basically I haven't heard it.
Lindsay, have you heard anything different?
I think that sounds about right.
So that doesn't sound very hopeful then for athletes would hope for perhaps some kind of union to help represent them. Well, so then let's talk about the other thing that Sally Bergeson pointed out, which is that she talked about the value of athletes to other brands being depressed because, say, at an event like the Olympics, they cannot wear any other logos other than, in this case, Nike, who owns the uniform that they're running in. Okay, so I get it, right? Like in non-Olympic game events, we can imagine all sorts of sports where their jerseys are just like covered with different logos. But the Olympics is the Olympics something different that it like we can't really we even like maybe the International Olympic Committee, who doesn't want branding of multiple companies to be part of the visual experience of the Olympics, Matt. I don't know, Matt, if you know about that.
Yeah, well, you know, Nike basically has a monopoly there. They've sponsored USATF and various Olympic teams around the world. And so, you know, when you watch an Adidas athlete or a Wazelle athlete win a medal, you're looking at Nike logos on their jersey and shorts. You know, they have to wear the kit of the sponsoring, supporting brand, and that happens to be Nike, and will be Nike until 2040. You know, they've signed a $500 million deal to fund USATF. So, you know, they pay for this thing to happen, and I don't see that changing anytime soon, unfortunately. But
well, Lindsay, what about other major events? I mean, we've talked about the Boston Marathon, the New York Marathon. I mean, these are also in the world of running, the highest profile global events. Is there a possibility for athletes to wear logos from sponsoring companies that aren't Nike, essentially?
Absolutely. And I think that is absolutely possible, and that's what they do. There isn't the same kind of broadcast rules that dictate the Olympics around different marathons. So I think something that's kind of interesting is like the rules around the Olympics are kind of taking the Olympics as this like mega world event that's kind of ceasing to be true. The Olympics doesn't have this, doesn't capture people's attention the way that it used to. So I think that's one thing. And another thing is social media. Athletes are now really able to reach their audience directly and cut out the broadcaster in many ways. And I think that's a whole other way for athletes to represent their brand and their sponsor these days.
Well, Lindsay Krause, senior staff editor at the New York Times, and Matt Hart, author of Win at All Costs, Inside Nike Running and Its Culture of Deception. Thank you both so very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.